Welcome to In 20XX. This series takes the listener, year by year, into the future. Ride the wave of change. If you like emerging tech, eco-tech, futurism, skepticism, apocalyptic survival scenarios, and disruptive science, sit back and enjoy short stories that showcase my research into how the future may play out.
Surrounding a town in the desert valley, giant wind turbines reach for the skies. Canyons and mountains shape the distant horizon. Folks work outside the many buildings of a botanical splicing center called the nursery. Bot-only construction crews wrap the larger buildings with carb mesh and pin it down. A mixing truck pours micrete into a boom truck intake funnel. Micrete pours out of the end of the boom onto a reinforced roof where bots spread it. Humes do the same to some of the houses and tiny homes. One femme, with glowing red hair, mixes micrete in a wheelbarrow and applies it to the outside of an RV as her dog goat whines and wags its tail. The hot sun beats down in the still, dry air. Nursery members decided to turn the existing buildings into storm shelters instead of building new, dedicated storm shelters. More than 200 people live and work in the nursery, and one out of three use Nuplus. Though Nuplus can turn the average Jane into a genius workaholic, it doesn't make people better manual laborers. The Nuplus users get in the way more than helping out. Instead of stapling mesh to a building, a Nuplus user comes up with a better plan for stormproofing and tries to stop operations to call on a vote to change plans. This sort of thing happens many times a day. Non-Nuplus users point the users toward other tasks like researching storm shelter varieties and driving out in the surrounding area to set up weather sensor towers. Daisuke and Marley take a jeep to the canyons. In his 30s, Daisuke has gotten thinner. When most wear disposable synthetic lignin clothes, he wears the more expensive clothes that require washing between uses. His clothes show wear and tear, yet still signal that he has money. As he watches the landscape, his expression relaxes into a look of concern. The canyon spreads out over hundreds of square kilometers. Stone pillars, cliffs, and crevices make it practically impassable. Much of the terrain requires rock climbing skills. Canyons have twists, turns, and dead ends that disorient travelers. Tall cliff walls obstruct views, making it difficult to gauge direction or locate landmarks. Most of the area lacks roads, signs, and clear paths. Internet service can be spotty, and these days, that means someone's navigation app can stop working. The jeep drives up Devil's Finger, a road used almost exclusively by a recluse who lives out here. The car autocorrects when wind gusts push it off the broken road. The air dries their skin. They climb altitude and see more and more hard blue sky. Marley, scrawny at nearly 40, sits saying little. His bangs make a straight line across his forehead. His collar shirt is buttoned tight to the top. Some scarring and discoloration on his face may indicate some time living outdoors. The road ends and they continue to drive across rocky land. Four quadcopters fly toward them as the jeep makes a sharp turn and stops. Both men get out. Their clothes flutter as they walk toward the drones that land in a line. The propellers shut off. Each drone is as wide as a car and remarkably light. When Daisuke picks one up, he's like an ant picking up a leaf. Both he and Marley carry the drones to the jeep and put them in the back. Daisuke explains loudly over the wind. They solar charge during the day and fly around mapping at night. Now that I'm in range, they're uploading all their mapping data onto my link. Marley says, "You think we'll find some missing person remains?" Daisuke smiles mildly. Maybe. In the community hub building, construction noises penetrate the walls from the outside, but the interior remains quiet. Before the moon cannon scare, people crowded the hub. Now most of the stations are vacant. Marley sits while Daisuke fires up the hologram table. The large circular table was assembled by someone as a DIY project. Daisuke loads the map of the canyon. The 3D hologram looks so real under the table surface that a cup on the table appears to float in the air. Though the drones mapped the canyons at night, the table hosts a daylight version detailed enough to render individual stones and leaves when zoomed in. Zoomed out, the map covers a 20-kilometer distance. Kalo, a Nuplus user, strides in, her head darting around like a bird. With bejeweled eyelashes, she sticks her head forward and smiles all the time. Spotting Daisuke, she approaches and calls out, "Whatcha doing?" Daisuke says, Searching for a good location, assistant, run flooding simulations on this map, add local weather history to a weather simulation, find areas least impacted by flash floods and where wind and temperature are at their lowest. Next to them, fans on a refrigerator-sized quantum computer start spinning. As Kalo reaches the table, blue tinting begins to show up on the map at various locations. She says, "Wow, you got the quantum computer working hard. Oh, those are the canyons. Every time I want to go exploring there, people talk me out of it." Marley says, "You'll get lost." She says, "That's what everyone tells me. Look at that. That makes a spiral, blue areas appearing. What are you looking for?" Daisuke says, "Canyons have microclimates. We're looking for the best microclimate where we can build storm shelters." She whistles and says, "But we're upgrading all the buildings here." Daisuke says, "And the nursery is right in the middle of a featureless flatland on top of rock. It's just about the worst place to build a storm shelter. Assistant, fly in closer here." He points down into a space between two cliffs. "The temp drop-off is good, but the wind is stronger. It must be a wind funnel." Marley says, "No plants. It could mean that rainwater doesn't stick around." Kalo fidgets. She jumps and says, "I want to help." More join Daisuke, Marley, and Kalo as they pack and move to the new location. The rest of the collective turns cold toward the breakout group. Over 200 people live on the nursery ground, and most have lived there for less than a year. But that doesn't stop the cold front from turning icier. In the early morning, as Daisuke packs lab equipment in bubble wrap and places it in synthetic collagen crates, a femme he doesn't recognize, wearing coveralls covered in dust, comes up to him and says, "Did you talk to anyone before packing that equipment?" Daisuke says, "We haven't met. My name is Daisuke. I own the nursery." With a look of disbelief, she freezes. Her mouth drops open and she walks backward before turning to go. Kalo, who takes apart the machine that swaps DNA and cells, snorts and says, "I think that's the angriest I've seen you get. I feel bad for her. She probably wanted to get in your good graces so she could score a leadership position. Which do you think is more human nature, war or bureaucracy?" "Oh, I just pinched my finger. Speaking of bureaucracy, do we have a rule against splicing animals? I know we do plants here, but I have a lot of ideas for animals." They leave the building. Kalo, a head shorter than Daisuke, talks nonstop. Daisuke carries a quadcopter drone on his back. The wind spins the blades. Lutenbots load the crates onto a flatbed for them. The buildings look strange, covered in micrete mounds. Daisuke feels a rush of dread. Is this really happening? If this is what everyone's doing, it must be bad, right? In the truck ride, Kalo says, "Hey, you gotta see this." She swipes left and an icon appears in Daisuke's view. He taps on it, opening a video. A professional femme's voice says, "Mind's Encore, the quest for digital immortality." A series of scenes show a man smiling as he speaks to an attentive audience. Then he rides in an autonocab through an upscale downtown. The voice continues, "Have you ever dreamed of living not just hundreds of years, but thousands? We at Mind's Encore want to help you reach that dream. Those who enroll will have their brains scanned at extremely high resolution, and the data collected will be stored for the day when it can be used to awaken a living instance of your mind in digital form." Video scenes show the Autono cab crash with a semi-truck, then the man's family grieving as he lies still in a hospital bed. She says, "Enrollment requires no hospital visits, no need to wear cumbersome recording devices. The scanning happens after an end-of-life event. Just sign up and rest assured that one day you may wake up as a digital being." The video shows a machine slice brain tissue and a band of light scans each slice. A cloud of letters and numbers comes together to form the man as he stands slowly turning and smiling. She says, "We've stored hundreds of brains, Nobel Prize winners, civil servants, industry pioneers, philanthropists, and stars. Our brain scans record atomic levels of detail. Though brain scans haven't yet been turned into living instances, don't let that stop you from seizing this opportunity. We're close to making emulated minds, and when we do, your data will be ready and waiting. Even if it takes 50 years before we achieve emulation, for you, it'll be like the blink of an eye." The scene shows the man riding a bike in a beautiful, color-saturated world. Daisuke says, "Are you going to sign up for this?" Kalo says, "I already have. This is better than cryogenics, where brain damage is more likely the longer someone is frozen. And who's to say we'll ever figure out how to restore a frozen person?" Daisuke doesn't say, but he wonders if a digitized copy of a brain is the same person, even if it acts exactly like that person. They arrive at a spot where not too long ago humans haven't set foot before, but now daily vehicle trips have carved a road. People and robots unload a jeep, a flatbed, and a moving truck. In the surrounding area, hoodoos and cliffs reach skyward. As afternoon nears, the heat climbs. Kalo takes off her long sleeve and ties it around her waist. Sweat dampens the upper edge of her t-shirt. She says, "I think if I weren't into microbiology, I'd have been in neuroscience. When we aren't simulating plant cells, I like to load up Hume neuron simulations. They're a lot like plants, don't you know? I could say that about any cell, but you know that. These days when I eat a carrot, I think this is just like eating a raw animal, really, right? Raw cells, you know? Do vegetarians ever think about that, that they're still eating meat, just plant meat instead of meat that moves? Some of them do, I'm sure. Well, people don't even eat animals anymore. Not like a side of cow." She tosses her long hair in an effort to get it out of her eyes, but it's so long it falls back where it was. Daisuke removes his wide-brim hat to wipe his forehead with his sleeve. His black hair sticks to his forehead. They lift a crate off the truck and carry it down a slope between two rocky hills. The two bots they have with them lift a second crate and follow. The hills soon become two cliffs on either side. Kalo says, "I was signed up to get frozen. Did you know you can have your whole body frozen or just your head? Haha, I don't want to see the frozen head department, but I just signed up to keep my head. By the time they can reanimate a brain, they'll have synthetic bodies. Cryogenics is more expensive than slice and scan. Keeping a brain frozen takes a lot of power. Like, I think they'll get digital brains working way before reanimating a frozen brain. You know, there'll be all kinds of tissue damage. I thought about having one finger frozen so I could have one original finger when they print me a new body. Is that gross? Do you have any gum? I see you chewing gum sometimes." Daisuke has learned that Nuplus users can perform simple tasks if you get them talking while they do it. He says, "I can give you a piece when we get to camp. What do you think your favorite plant is?" She says, "You and your plants. You're crazy about plants. Anyone ever tell you that?" I guess the grasses. Like, I like their strategy. They send out all those shoots, and a new shoot will send up blades as high as possible to grab sunlight. If I were a plant, I think I'd be a grass. You know, I was thinking about the nitrogen fixing problem, and I think finding new ways for plants to fix nitrogen is worth working on. I know it seems like a huge leap, but have you played with the latest Life Evolver AI? It's a lot better. He says, "I wonder what it's like programming the microbes that grow protein computers. I imagine it's a lot more complicated than combining plant DNA. She gets an expression like a child's on Christmas morning. She says, "Oh, it's pretty cool how they do it. They reverse engineered various shell builder animals and first programmed microbes to build shell fragments into certain shapes. The microbes grow gates in fractal patterns. Seriously, it's beautiful." Voices bounce off the cliff walls. Trinidad, Debbie, and Denny pass them on their way back to the cars, followed by a mover bot that stands much taller than the Humes. Though it's bipedal, its shell is painted bulldozer yellow and it can lift cars. Trinidad says, "There's no reception after that first turn." Daisuke says, "I plan on fixing that soon." She says, "How will you do that?" He says, "Are you all using Medusa?" They all nod. He says, "I bought a box of old Link anklets. Remember those? I can install Medusa on them and drop them on this path. They'll each solar charge and act as internet relays." The ground thumps as the mover bot passes Daisuke and Kalo. Denny calls back, "Hey, who invited Mars?" Daisuke takes a breath. He calls back, "Don't call him that." Denny's smile fades and he turns to face the direction of the cars. Sun lights up the matte finish on the lumbering mover bot as its gorilla arms sway at its sides. Kalo says, "Who's Mars? Isn't he that drunk?" Daisuke says, "His name is Javier." Daisuke changes how he holds the crate. A crate he moved earlier left scratches on his arms. They walk over flat stones and he makes sure not to step on any loose rocks. He says, "Do you remember when Mars Colony 1 failed?" She says, "Yes, the news didn't cover anything else." Carrying the other side of the crate doesn't seem to tire her the way it does him. He says, "He was one of the lead designers for that mission. He designed a lot of the equipment." She says, "Bag of cats. I had no idea." He says, "A whole town formed around that mission, Marstown, Texas. And after it failed, several people in that town killed themselves. It's a ghost town now." She says, "Bloody hell." He says, "I guess his wife went on the mission." She says, "What, to Mars? Are you kidding me?" He says, "No." She says, "No wonder." They tread carefully down a rocky slope as the cliffs on either side grow taller. In shade, a steady, cool breeze cools their legs instead of the hot gusts coming off the desert valley. Their eyes adjust. Microclimates are underappreciated. Last week, he set up a weather monitoring system at the new shelter site and recorded that, on average, the temperature there is 15 degrees cooler than at the nursery. Wind movement is much less, and humidity is higher. To get that kind of improvement by moving to another macro climate, they'd have to move to Montana. Both their links at the same time say, "Warning, you are offline." Data from People's Canal links indicate that over 500 people have relocated to the nursery and surrounding area. The last time Daisuke saw anything like it was when he went to Burning Man. To the west, where ghost suburbs occupy the valley, RVs, campers, and tents are set up. Children run around dressed for city life as folks who don't know how to handle the harsh sunlight turn abandoned houses and dilapidated box stores into shelters. Though people are courteous, the mood feels chaotic. These people are running from something. They come from all over. Why'd they come all the way out here? At least the plant splicers who make up the original nursery have forgotten about their anger towards Daisuke's breakaway group. Maybe around 50 people make up the Canyon Group, as they're now called. Some of the biologists who argued the loudest that Daisuke shouldn't pull people to go build shelters in the canyons have joined his group after coming out and seeing for themselves the microclimate between two majestic cliffs. The two cliffs run side by side for a few kilometers. Near where one of the cliffs ends, the distance between the cliffs increases, and the terrain becomes more diverse with hoodoos, rocky inclines, crags, and even what barely count as woods. Here's where the 50 or so set up shelters. Barefoot children play under an overhang. Mover bots fitted with picks and shovels dig rectangular holes. People fill bags with dirt and pile them against longhouses. The temperature here is an ideal 20 degrees Celsius, and though winds have been strong in this part of Nevada, the air between the cliffs remains mostly still. Sun hits the ground for only 40 minutes in the middle of the day. The rest of the time, people work in pleasant shade. A femme who helps assemble a pavilion whose roof is solar panels says, "We should have moved here years ago. We won't need to run AC." Four people and two bots, covered in dust, return from putting up weather towers in the surrounding area. The bots wear backpacks filled with tools. The Humes look worn out. The lead Hume walks over to piles of supplies, pipes, cables, spikes, solar panels, and boxed weather stations. He turns to the others and says, "What do you say? You think we can set up another before we call it a day?" The beating of propeller blades echoes off the cliffs and people look up. A sky crane flies into sight. A femme wearing a hijab calls out, "Daisuke, he's back." Daisuke steps out from under an awning on a trailer. The femme points and he walks toward where the crane lowers its load, a good distance away from the cliffs. By the time he reaches the spot below the crane, a flatbed suspended by cables casts a shadow on the ground. In his 60s, Javier stands on the flatbed holding onto a cable. There's hardly any room for him as the bed is loaded with junk. One side touches down first and the flatbed tilts until the other side makes contact. Not far from them, a larger pile of junk clutters the irregular ground. Daisuke walks toward Javier and says, "Hi, Javier." Javier bends to unclip a cable on the corner. Daisuke says, "I heard you started a project over here. I'm interested in what your plan is." Javier turns and stands. His once buzz-cut hair now waves in the breeze and sunlight lights it up like a halo. He smirks bitterly and says, "Well, Daisuke, if I must answer to the rumor mill, what you see here is redundancy." Daisuke says, "Oh, like if we need a part, we can salvage it?" Javier sneers as he smiles. He says, "Yes and yes and yes." Daisuke says, "Where'd you get all this?" Javier says, "I'm not going to do things like before. I bought a junkyard near Reno so I could pick out all the parts I want instead of ordering each one separately. Some people I know would still be alive if they had a few spare parts. You hear me?" When Javier tears up, Daisuke looks at the ground. Good grief, this guy wears his heart on his sleeve. Daisuke says, "How much more of this are you going to bring?" Javier answers before Daisuke finishes his question. "As much as I damn well can. My Reno junkyard's got robots from the turn of the century to today. It's got industrial equipment, old sky cranes, early retrofitting robots." He spits on the ground. Daisuke nods. "Well, I'll leave you to it." He turns and heads back. Javier says, "I know what I'm doing. I designed Mars One. I know habitats, power systems, air purification, dust control." Still walking away, Daisuke says, "Yes." Javier says, "It's not before you need it, it's when you need it." Daisuke heads to the first completed longhouse. He's as tall as the building because over half of it sits underground. dirt bags piled against the walls and on the roof give it a mound shape. He walks through the sloped doorway and down some steps to the dim interior. Inside, Kahlo stands with her glasses frosted over, waving her hands. Two robots install pipes on tall brew tanks, and a third robot hooks up electric lines. The system they set up will brew meat and dairy products. Daisuke walks up to her and says, "How's it going?" Her glass is clear, and she says, "Thank you for letting me do this." He says, "I know you've been dealing with boredom lately." She says, "Yes, when will we get power?" Daisuke points up. "Marley's at the top of the cliff setting up solar. I don't know when, but it should be soon." She says, "Have you heard of Bioheritage Guardians?" Daisuke says, "No." She says, "They go all over the world collecting DNA from every kind of life form. You know the couple we saw yesterday with the bot dogs, the ones wearing the green bandanas?" Daisuke says, "Yeah." She says, "They were guardians. They want to map the world's DNA before the world ends." Daisuke says, "That sounds like a good idea." She says, "They asked if they could come here if, you know." Daisuke says, "Well, sure, I can't imagine why we'd turn people away." She says, "Oh, and did you know the pack of kids we have here found a dead homeless guy?" He says, "What? No." She says, "He's in a cave over that way. He's mostly a skeleton. Some of his stuff is still there, like clothes and empty tin cans." Daisuke says, "He wasn't homeless." She says, "What?" He says, "If he was in a cave, he wasn't homeless." She says, "I guess not." He says, "The kids shouldn't go too far. People get lost every year." She says, "Yes, Dad, everyone knows that. I think one of the parents has a drone fly over them, always keeping an eye on them." He takes his Jeep back to the nursery. The buildings have been buried under piles of mycrete. They don't look like buildings anymore, more like giant brown igloos. Maybe the nursery will do just fine. Maybe he didn't need to convince a group to build shelters in the canyons. People on the grounds head this way and that, busy as usual. Many smile at him as he walks between the water purification tanks and microhomes. As he rounds the giant mound covering the main building, the garden comes into view. This is the greening of the desert garden that's drawn people from around the world. From one glance, he can tell it's gone wild because the gardeners have diverted efforts to shelter building. "If we can grow here, we can grow anywhere," the younger Daisuke said in a podcast he's most quoted from. "You do water, don't you?" the podcaster asked. "No," he said. "Anyone can convert a desert into arable land. What we're doing is speeding up evolution and adapting wild plants to this land. Now some of the palm variants grow two stories high and cast wide shadows. Sand moss covers the ground, holding in moisture and giving soil-building bacteria a place to call home. None of the fruit-bearing cacti produced anything edible, but they look pretty. The thistle tree looks like a plant from another planet, and it's able to send out seeds that grow into baby trees. The garden covers many acres, and visitors can walk a trail that takes them through it. The organization hasn't limited its efforts to desert plants. Now they have corn that grows in salt water. The nursery sewer feeds a whole section of the garden. The plants thrive and filter water at the same time. In what looks like a greenhouse, plants give off too much water. Living off gray water from kitchens, sinks, and showers, these plants sweat drinkable water that can be captured and bottled. A family of four poking at the stomach plants look up at Daisuke as he passes. The father says, "Doing some gardening?" Daisuke smiles sadly. "No, just coming to visit." The stomach plants sit on a rock wall. Their roots grow inward into cavities in the bloated stalks. The plants flourish as long as someone feeds soil into the cavities. They can grow on stones because they don't try to penetrate the ground with roots. One of the kids pushes a stomach plant and laughs when it rocks back and forth. Stomach plants are also stolen more often than any other kind of plant. Daisuke walks up a rocky incline. Some of the plants crowd out others. If gardeners don't get back to work here soon, some of the variants may die out. The food garden is still maintained. People must eat, shelter building or no shelter building. He reaches down, plucks a peach tomato, and bites into it. It tastes like a peach with just a hint of tomato, and it grows on a vine. Pineapple tomatoes, banana tomatoes, splices like these have turned the nursery into a cash cow, even though that wasn't the plan. The grape arbor is nice to walk under. The canopy of vines and leaves blocks out most of the sun. He finds some of the oddly colored grapes. These taste like off-the-shelf candy. These aren't his favorites, but he must eat some and remember the experience. Past the arbor, the shade cactuses grow high and cast shadows on what used to be sun-stressed ground. Cacti may have never evolved to give other life a chance by providing patches of shade, but now some do. In a grove, the ivory agaves grow large, with off-white tusks extending from the center of the plants. A plant that grows real ivory shocked the world. When Humes learned that ivory can be gotten without killing elephants, they purchased it and revived lost carving and jewelry-making arts. An Iari message pops up. He air taps it and says, "Hello?" A picture of Selyse appears, anchored to the ground. She says, "Hey, Daisuke, I was hoping we could talk sometime." The picture shows her wearing a combat beret and a twisted smile. He says, "I'm in the garden." She says, "Oh, I didn't know you were here. Where in the garden?" He says, "By the ivory." She says, "Stay there, I'm coming." A few minutes later, she strides up the path, her 5 long ponytails bouncing off her back. She purses her lips like she's ready to give the kiss of death, and she carries an umbrella longer than she is tall. DIY made, its canopy is tarp material. She says, "Are you resting?" He says, "Hold on." He swipes up, then air taps to enter privacy mode. "Okay, now I am." She sticks the umbrella in the dirt and they both duck under it. The foil underside reflects light. She says, "The robins have a stalker." He says, "How do they know? Where are they?" She says, "Eureka, Arkansas." Bee's AI alerted her. Even though the stalker wears disguises, he doesn't alter his movement profile enough. Daisuke pulls his hat off and brushes the bangs off his forehead. "Well, they should abort," she says. "They can't change destinations?" He says, "No, I mean tell them to stay where they are and play tourist." Selyse grunts affirmatively. When Daisuke walks back to his jeep, Marley calls from the condo houses, "Boss, are you heading to the canyons?" Daisuke stops and looks Marley over. Marley wears a t-shirt and jeans, but are those the sort of clothes he's used to wearing? There must be spies here, surely there are. The news airs stories of eco-terrorists seeding invasive Frankenstein plants, and here the nursery is world famous for splicing plant genes. Where does Marley come from? Seems he's too small to be a soldier, but doesn't that make him perfect as a spy? Daisuke says, "Yeah, come on, I'm leaving now." Marley walks around a fence carrying a box. "Okay, boss." Daisuke never liked being called boss. He shrugged it off, but now it stands out. They climb into the jeep and Daisuke says, "Take us to the canyon." The jeep reverses, turns around, and heads to the main road. Daisuke says, "What you got in the box?" Marley says, "Oh, it's Abraham, my pet rat." Daisuke says, "I don't remember you having a pet." Marley says, "He's not just any old rat. He's 15. He's one of the world's oldest rats." Daisuke says, "That's old for a rat?" Marley says, "Very. But the oldest rat is 28. We're all waiting for it to die so our rats have a better chance of being the oldest." He chuckles and peeks through a gap in the flaps on the top of the box. Daisuke says, "Have I ever asked where are you from?" Marley's smile turns to a frown. He speaks more carefully. "Have you ever heard of Dark Star Ranch?" Daisuke feels a lump in his chest. "Dark like dark ops? Ranch like stealth training ranch?" He says, "I haven't." Marley says, "It was a commune. I'm third generation Dark Star. In the 70s, my grandparents got fed up with air pollution, toxic chemicals, endangered species. They didn't want to be any part of it." Marley's head locks looking forward. His jaw muscles flex and he sounds angry. "Dark Star Ranch was formed out in the middle of nowhere in California, and we did it all ourselves, relying only on the land. We made our butter and grew our own food." Daisuke feels pity, but isn't that a perfect story to elicit his pity? "Wouldn't a spy have just a story like that ready to disarm people?" Marley says. "And we all worked together. It was paradise. My upbringing was full of kindness toward nature and toward each other. I couldn't have had a better childhood. While America made capitalism into a monster that turned on the public, we learned self-reliance." He speaks with urgency. Daisuke says, "Sounds nice. Why'd you leave?" Marley says, "Climate change happened." He swallows hard and scrunches his eyes closed for a second. Daisuke says, "You mean..." Marley says, "The first fire took out most of the farm. People died. We couldn't sell at the farmer's market anymore, but we managed to grow enough to survive. We rebuilt, but the water crisis took everyone by surprise." Daisuke leans away from Marley. He says, "Where'd you go?" Marley shakes his head. "My mom and us kids were homeless. We were in Berkeley at first." Daisuke's suspicions fall away. "This guy isn't a spy. Look at him." He says, "Wait, you kept a rat alive for 15 years? Marley laughs with watery eyes. "Yes!" Daisuke says, "How do you do that?" Marley says, "I can show you the Discord group." Natara Simon starts out at daybreak and takes his herd of sheep down a trail to the power line corridor near Martha's Vineyard. The old truss transmission towers hold buzzing power lines high above him and his 55 sheep. A strip of property below the towers remains open and grassy, cutting a wide line through the forest. As his sheep wander onto the grassy land, Natara gazes out at the open space that holds back the forest. Wind turbines spin in the distance. Above, fluffy clouds and blimps cross a blue sky. The sheep baa as Natara's two quadruped robots herd them. Natara straightens his bow tie and tucks his shirt in. Always someone comes out to see his sheep and take pictures. As a living relic of the past, he doesn't mind the attention. Yesterday, two femmes brought a herd of children out to see the sheep. One of the femmes asked, "Is it okay for you to have your sheep by these power lines?" He said, "They like that I bring my sheep here. My sheep are pictured on the power company website." The femme laughed, as Natara was confident she would. Normally, he feels a cool breeze on his back, but today the wind hits him head-on and it feels unusually warm, hot even. He senses a silence and after a moment realizes that the lines above have stopped buzzing. A gust of wind knocks him backward. He lands square on his back and scrambles to get up. The sheep turn circles and break up into smaller groups. Above, blimps and clouds pass faster than he's ever seen them move before. Darker clouds appear ahead and draw over the blue sky. He says, "Assistant, herd the sheep back home?" The two bots prance to the front of the herd in order to push it back. But the sheep are spooked and spread out in all directions, some zigzag running while others turn in circles. Natara steps backward. The day grows dark as thick clouds pass over. Fog clouds fly past him, briefly cutting off the distance he can see when enveloping him while passing. His face grows damp. Water droplets form on the blades of grass. A sheep knocks him over and he falls back again. When he gets to his feet, he needs to dodge sheep stampeding from all directions. The wind turbines furthest from him fold down. The next nearer fold down, then the next. The ground shakes. A blimp caught in a gale descends. Suddenly it comes down in the forest nearby. As big as a barge, it crashes into trees, releasing screeches, cracking and snapping as loud as gunfire. Natara falls to his knees as one by one the transmission towers fold over toward him. Countless objects fly past him and land in the field. Branches, a bucket, a rag, shingles, birds. Winds come at him from all directions. A large branch side swipes him. A power line tower hits the ground next to him with a deafening crash. The distance he can see changes from second to second. At one point, he can see some of his sheep that are far ahead rise and fly back. He grabs onto clumps of grass, hears stomping hooves and fearful snorts, but can only see thick fog. For another moment, he can see far enough to witness half his herd lift off the ground like bubbles in the surf. In the evening, the Canyon Group adults sit in a circle on folding chairs or on the dirt. Their kids sit in an adjacent circle. Brewed meat cooks on hydrogen grills that have open flames but don't give out smoke. People eat from lignin plates on their laps. Synthetic lignin has replaced nearly all paper and cloth products. Lignin is made by engineered microbes that turn food waste into papery and fiber materials. Synthetic lignin requires 90% less water to make than plant-grown products. Plants transpire a huge amount of water. Growing a traditional plant crop involves a lot of water lost to the air. Synthetic lignin doesn't involve such a loss of water. A Tran, Billie Jean with purple curls, teaches another how to knit with lignin yarn. She says, "I like that we can all sit outside. We couldn't do this at the nursery, not even in the evening." Sitting outside the circle, four men improvise a quiet song on guitar, fiddle, banjo, and tabla drums. Two puppies play tug-of-war with a rope. 10 longhouses next to the base of a cliff stand complete, each buried under mounds and each with sloped doors. Along the other cliff base, many permatents stand with amenities such as heat pumps and sponge-off basins. The beginning of a hemp field further up the canyon soaks up water from a drip line. Though it's summer, some put on jackets which you don't see in other parts of Nevada. Javier storms out of a longhouse, bottle in hand, calling out, "No, no, no, this ain't gonna work." The music stops. Daisuke, who's accepting a ladybug from one of Jill's daughters, looks over at Javier as others do. Javier saunters into the circle. "It won't work. Is solar your only high volt power? You're going to lose all your panels during the first storm. We aren't in town anymore. You can't order more from Giantess. Without power, how are you going to make food? You have a fancy brew system that requires lots of power. The algae beds are better than trying to grow produce, but yours requires electricity. Do you know there are systems that don't need electricity?" His head bobs as he looks from one sour expression to the next. Some in the group begin to interrupt, but Daisuke raises his hand to tell them to wait. Javier continues, "And those saltwater tanks? Those are great, but what are you going to do when the water runs out? You dug holes and put up outhouses on them. Don't you know you're just pissing away all your water when you do that? You need to build a system that can sustain on its own, like on Mars," Trevor the guitarist says. He looks around for laughs, but gets none. Javier looks directly at Trevor as he stumbles toward him. Javier says, "Do you think this is a game? Do you think all these people put aside their lives and built all this out here just for shits and giggles? Are you really that stupid?" Trevor's expression freezes where it is. Daisuke grabs Javier's arm and says, "Javier, listen. Just walk over here with me. I want to listen to you, so let's just go over here." He leads Javier away from the circle where glow lamps hold back the increasing darkness. Javier complies and says, "I screwed up. I screwed up real bad, Daisuke. Have you ever been married?" Fat tears fall off his droopy face. Daisuke says, "Listen, I think you can be a real help. I want you to go over everything with me. Do you know some preppers came out here earlier and just laughed at our setup?" Javier laughs, "Yeah, I saw that. Want to know a secret? I invited them." Daisuke says, "But I need you to sleep off your drunk first. Let's talk about it tomorrow." Javier says, "You just let all your water go. You need to hold on to every drop." Daisuke says, "Yes, I see what you're saying. Let's do something about that tomorrow." For the last 5 days, the storm has forced them to shelter inside the longhouses. Daisuke sits in House 3, where the computers and splice equipment are kept. None of it works for lack of power. Daisuke, Kalo, Joan, and her son Clip sit on chairs as they attend a group call. The call is left open all the time, and anyone can listen in and talk when they need to. It acts a lot like radio channels used to act. Because they all use Medusa, they still have internet on a very local level. Daisuke says, "We're almost out of food and water over here." Javier in House 4 says, "I'm right next door to you. I wish I could figure out a way to get supplies to you." Marley, also in House 4, says, "We have a couple of mover bots here. Why can't we have one take food to them?" Javier says, "They may be able to lift a car, but mover bots aren't that heavy, and they have a lot more surface than a Hume. The wind will blow them away." Cahol moans, "Why'd the storm have to come when it did? I was going to order extra new plus." In the dim light, her eyelids droop and her head hangs. Marley says, "That settles it. I'm going over there. I have a plan." Many voices speak up. "No, Marley." And, "We've already lost people." Marley says, "We have a carb fiber tank here. If I fill it with water, I can put it in a backpack, and it'll weigh me down. Also, I can crawl there." Daisuke says, "I won't let you do it. We'll lock the doors here. We won't let you in." Marley says, "You wouldn't do that." Debbie from the nursery breaks in, "Folks, this in community hub. We have a problem here." For a millisecond after she pauses, the sound of structural shaking comes over the line before the sound filter takes it out. She says, "The building's been shifting. Just a little at first. It's starting to move more." The longer she talks, the more scared she sounds. Daisuke feels like an elephant stands on his chest. The community hub is 3 stories, at least 80 people shelter there. He's already heard the last cries for help as other nursery buildings have broken up in the wind. Other buildings in the area have broken up and flown right into nursery buildings. Cars and buses have rammed the buildings. The people who migrated the school wanted it to still have windows, so the 40 or so people there cried out as their shelter blew apart on day one of the storm. Debbie says, "I don't know what to do." Against his better judgment, Daisuke air motions to launch a video stream of the community hub interior. Night vision shows the open first floor with its high ceiling shaking. He gasps. It isn't just rocking, it's shaking violently. Hume shapes huddle together on the floor or dart from one place to the next. Clouds of dust or smoke fall from above. He disbelieves what he sees as the entire interior bends. Lines become slantier. Debbie says, "Where can we go?" The feed changes as the ceiling rips apart and daylight floods the scene. In a blur, everything, bodies, furniture, and walls fly away from the camera. The feed becomes meaningless as the camera spins. The call line remains silent. The live feed says, "Signal lost." Daisuke neglects to close the video app as he drops his head down in his hands. It's his fault. He ditched his people. He should have argued with them every day. Even if they never listened, he should have. He gave up on them so quickly. Debbie was one of the first to join the nursery. He deserves to die. He doesn't know what the others are doing or how much time has passed when Marley says, "I'm coming over." Anger reignites Daisuke's mind. He says, "Marley, don't try to be a hero. We need you to stay alive." Marley says, "I'm coming over, be ready for me, this shouldn't take long." Kalo, who acts sluggish because she's been off Nuplis for a few days, says, "Let him try." Marley's voice heaves as he says, "The doors won't open." People in other longhouses try, their doors won't budge. Many speak one after the other, "The doors are blocked. It feels like we're buried. We're buried alive." The pounding that we heard yesterday, it's a lot quieter today. Will we be about to dig our way out after the storm ends? Javier, who ran out of booze on the same day Kalo ran out of Nuplus, says, "Dig." A few minutes of silence follows. He says, "Daisuke, go to the side closest to us. Break out the floor and dig. Dig a tunnel to us." Daisuke says, "We don't have shovels." Javier says, "Improvise, man. Use a spoon if you have to. We can use the mover bots on our side. One bot will dig to you, and the other can dig to house 5. Daisuke says, "Where will you put the dirt?" Javier says, "We'll figure it out."
Thank you for listening. Please take the time to rate, review, and subscribe so that more future-minded people can find this show. My landing page is in20xx.com. There, you can find the companion website to this podcast that includes an illustrated timeline and glossary.